This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hello, everyone. How lovely to see such a beautiful full house this evening. Thank you very much for all making it here to question time. This is our third question time of the year. If you've never been to this series before, welcome. If you have been before, welcome back. My name is Madeline Morris. I'm the host of the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre. About once a month, we have one of these sort of forums where we get experts in a particular subject along to talk to us and share their knowledge and answer all the questions that you can throw at them. So keep an eye out for future events. So if any of you looked at the budget last week, which I'm sure many of you did, you will have noticed one of the headline policies, and it's the trial in three testing sites of testing welfare recipients for drugs. Basically, the deal is going to be that three strikes and you lose your benefits. Now, even though it's going to be a very small reach, it obviously had a huge amount of media attention. Many quarters of the media were very supportive of it. Plenty of punters on Talkback Radio very supportive of it. Plenty of experts were very disparaging of it. But it is effectively continuing in the same vein the broad arc of drugs policy in Australia, which has always been much more stick than carrot. Now, drugs policy is largely a state-based issue, and here in Victoria, we also have quite a relatively punitive system for both users as well as dealers. So tonight we want to look at whether this is working, and if not, what is not working and what we might be able to replace it with. So the figure is this: around 2 in 5 Australians have used illicit drugs at least once. Most of that will be marijuana, but nonetheless, the figure is quite high. It's around 42%. Very few of those people, relatively few, go on to actually have problems with drugs, and very few will get involved in crime. But, however, there are huge amounts of police resources and court resources poured into dealing with that crime. Is that a good use of our resources? That's one of the good things, one of the things that we're going to be talking about tonight. Now, here in Melbourne, a coroner's report in February called for a safe injecting room in Richmond. There were 34 overdose deaths in Richmond last year alone. That the Premier has ruled that out. So that's sort of the political lie of the land on that, but there is going to be a parliamentary inquiry into it. And just sort of in that same vein, Port Phillip Council rejected earlier this year a request for pill testing sites at music festivals, despite a huge amount of harm that has recently come from people overdosing on pills and other drugs at music festivals. So that's sort of where we are politically at this stage. And one of the things that we want to talk tonight about is whether it's time to change the narrative, whether we need to be looking at other jurisdictions such as Portugal, which basically decriminalised drugs 15 years ago and since then have seen reduction in overdoses, reduction in use of drugs, and certainly a reduction in drug-related crime. So we actually have a really fantastically knowledgeable and diverse panel here this evening to talk about this. I'll introduce them all in a moment. But just so that you know, this is question time. This is your opportunity to ask questions. It's not a panel discussion. I'm not going to be up here asking 50 questions. If you'd like to ask a question, that's exactly what we're here to give you the opportunity to do. So please put your hand up. Try and catch the eye of the two ushers. It's quite difficult for me to see up here sort of who is, and also to keep a track of who's putting their hand up. So put your hand up, keep an eye on the ushers, and they'll come to you and give you the microphone and just signal. They'll signal to me when we've got a question. So we'll have a few brief introductions, then I'm going to throw the floor open to questions. My tip is, as always, get your question in early, otherwise, because we always have a flurry at the end and people don't get them answered. So let me just introduce the panel and we'll get rolling. So over on the far left of me, I suppose, stage left, is Nicole Lee. Now, she is director at specialist drug and alcohol consultancy 360 Edge, and she's a professor at the National Drug Research Institute. She's a practicing psychologist in the substance abuse and mental health sectors, and she is one of the country's foremost experts on alcohol and drug clinical policy. Assistant Commissioner Rick Nugent is hiding, not being in uniform tonight, which is very cunning of you, Rick. He's the Assistant Commissioner for the Eastern Region of Victoria Police, and he has had a police career spanning nearly three decades, much of which he spent as a detective, and that saw him investigating many serious crimes, including drug trafficking. He's also just started a review within Victoria Police of their approach to policing drug crimes. And Stan Winford is Associate Director at the Centre for Innovative Justice, which is at RMIT University. He's a practising lawyer, and he has been involved in drug law reform for a very long time, including at state government level. He has plenty of grassroots experience too. He was the drug outreach lawyer at the Fitzroy Legal Service. He's also the chair of the Mental Health Legal Centre and the author of the Drug Offences chapter in the Law Handbook. I could actually spend the entire night introducing these guests and the long list of accomplishments they've had. I've given you the very short version here. But they are, needless to say, extremely accomplished in their field. So because we are here talking about drug law reform and drug policy, Stan, I just wanted to start with you, just to sort of bring us up to speed, if you can, on where Victoria is in terms of its approach to policing, punishing, rehabilitating drug use and supply.
Well, drugs in Victoria are regulated under the Drugs, Poisons and Controlled Substances Act. It's a 1981 act. It's regularly amended, often to create new offences and increased penalties for drug-related offences. And there's a whole spectrum of offences that cover use of a drug of dependence, possession of a drug of dependence, trafficking, and it's the penalties for trafficking are linked to the quantities of drugs that people are apprehended with. And there's also a cultivation for sort of botanical drugs like cannabis and so on. So the sentencing laws are set out in the Drugs Act applied by the courts, and the police obviously enforce those laws. We've got a range of different ways that we deal with drug offences in the courts. We've got the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Court in Dandenong, which has recently been expanded to Melbourne, which offers really a carrot and stick approach to dealing with probably the hard end of drug offenders who've spent a lot of their lives committing offences related to drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And then at the lower end of the scale, we've got sort of police have the power to caution people. There's drug diversion and other things like that are really aimed at sort of dealing with lower level offenders and allowing them to kind of not get caught up in the criminal justice system, which itself can be particularly harmful and damaging, almost more so than the drugs themselves at times.
So we're trying to move away, broadly speaking, from certainly initial offenders and low-level offenders from getting involved in the criminal justice system, going to jail, etc. Is that working?
I don't think we're quite there yet. I think if you look at the history of people who pass through our courts and return again and again, we can see that we're still not managing successfully sort of deal with people at that lower end of the scale for whom the sort of criminalisation of drug use and possession is the issue rather than any other offending. And in fact, as we know, the fact that drugs are illegal produces a whole lot of other harms which catch those people out. So there's both the health effects, so people can't get access to treatment effectively, and then there's simply the fact that if you've got a drug addiction, you might be committing offences in order to feed your habit.
Mm. We'll certainly come back to the drug court because that's a very interesting area of the criminal justice system in this space. Rick, how much time do you think police actually spend dealing with drug-related issues, which is not only supplying drugs but also crime to feed drug habits and associated crimes such as family violence following on from drug use?
Yeah, so it's broken down, it's broken down into a range of areas. So our frontline police respond to calls from the public generally. So whether that's family violence, violence on the streets, the road trauma. So a significant part of their time is attributed to drug-related matters, and that's all types of drugs, alcohol and illicit drugs, and sometimes the combination of licit and illicit drugs. And then it sort of scales up to various areas. So we have areas that will target suppliers. So we'll have detectives targeting suppliers, right through to our crime command who really target the top-end importers. So it's sort of broken up into those areas.
Sure. So there's many, many levels. If we're just going to be talking about the lowest level, yep. So dealing with the frontline stuff, the small use, small possession, perhaps small-time dealing and the resulting crime and social crimes. Yep. Do you think that that's a valuable use of police time to be policing that?
So in terms of the possess and use, we don't task to that. So
what does that mean?
Well, we don't task our police to go and target possess and use.
Right.
We target the suppliers that are causing the harm in the community, that are getting people addicted to drugs. So in terms of proper use of our resources, we are responding to calls from the public from the harm that is caused from the drugs, not for the possess and use, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But from what you're saying, it sounds as though a large portion of police time and energy is going into the drug space.
It's certainly in responding to the calls from the community. And when I visit the police stations, I visit the rural areas. Rural areas particularly are just, there's enormous trauma that's occurred, enormous harm in the rural communities from drugs. And so I talk to the detectives, I talk to the front line, and it's predominantly ICE is what they're responding to. Mm-hmm. So together, the main areas that our police are responding to, family violence, ICE, mental illness, but where it's impacting on the community and community harm.
Mm-hmm. So Nicole, you're coming from a different approach, I suppose, that's not necessarily law-based. You're coming more from a psychological perspective. So explain to us the work that you actually do with drug users.
Well, a lot of the work is, I guess, in the past I've done some clinical work, but most of my personal work now is working with services and policymakers to not develop up policy, but to see how we can better apply it and improve service provision, particularly in terms of both treatment and harm reduction.
Mm-hmm. One of the quotes that you wrote for an article in The Conversation, you said, some of the greatest harms from using illicit drugs come because they're illegal. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think Stan just alluded to that earlier, that the fact that that illicit drugs are illegal comes with its own harms because sometimes people get caught up in the legal system who are not really, perhaps not committing other crimes, but their only crime is that they've been caught with some drugs. And things like young people at festivals, for example, when you see the sniffer dogs and kids get caught with, bags of ecstasy or whatever, that means that, perhaps that was an error in judgment on their behalf, or perhaps they were on a career path. But either way, there's harms associated with them being arrested and charged with drug-related crimes.
Does that mean that you would like to see drugs made legal or decriminalised?
Yeah, I think the evidence internationally is, particularly from Portugal, is that at least decriminalisation takes away some of those harms. But it's still, it still means that those drugs are illegal and there's still consequences just from using drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that's a kind of, in my perspective, a bit of a moral judgment. In the same way, I kind of think of, in the 70s, homosexuality was illegal, because that was a bit of a moral judgment from society. And I think we are moving, the majority of the community, when we do surveys, agree with decriminalisation, and a sizeable proportion agree with legalisation as well.
Okay. Just before we move on to questions, is there such a thing as a typical profile of someone who uses illicit drugs?
No, there's not.
Just a human being?
It's pretty broad, yeah,
right.
And people come from all kinds of socioeconomic education backgrounds, family backgrounds. There's certainly risk factors for problematic use. There are things like low socioeconomic conditions, poor education. So, we really want to try and keep kids in school, for example, and reduce the disparity in income and education in the community in order to kind of keep the harms contained.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen in your work as well just that growing use that, and concerns that Rick was talking about in rural areas in particular, and in particular to do with ice use?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of concern in rural areas. There's not a lot of evidence that there's a huge increase in use, but what happens in a regional area, there's two kind of things, I think, that impact on that perception that there's a bigger problem there. The use of most drugs is a bit higher in regional areas, not just ice, but also a whole range of other illicit drugs. But in a small area, those people are going to be much more visible, and particularly methamphetamine and ice being the one form of that, is a kind of very active kind of drug, and so that people do tend to be a lot more visible. On the flip side of that, the other thing in regional areas is that there's a real dearth of treatment services and harm reduction services, and so not only is there a high rate of use, people are more visible, but there's nowhere really for them to go to get help if they need to.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll come to that in the questions this evening. So let's have some questions. And can I remind you, I'm sure that you all of you have an opinion on these issues. If we could keep the opinion part to the smaller side and the questions to the larger side, that would be fantastic. Yes, please.
Thank you, panel. With regard to Operation Safe Nine in Victoria, given that dogs are wrong so much of the time, what do you see as the main point of this in Melbourne?
Can you explain what Operation Safe Night is, please, for everyone?
Certainly. Operation Safe Night is the police using dogs in nightclub precincts from now until August on irregular Saturdays, targeting small-time users, also posing as undercover buyers and inspecting vehicles outside this area. It's operated twice, using 15 to 30 both closed and undercover police officers. And so far there's been 30 charges, only two of which haven't gone to drug diversion programs.
Only two of which haven't gone to drug diversion programs. Okay. So, the question again, sorry, in all of that explanation, I've lost the question.
What do you see as the point of Operation Safe Night in Melbourne?
Thank you. I think that might one be for you, Rick, I think.
I think it might be. So, the pad dog strategy was introduced probably 10 or so years ago in response to a significant number of overdoses that were occurring at some of these festivals. The strategy was developed in consultation with some other agencies, health as well, looking at how do we disrupt the supply of drugs that is causing the harm, how do we identify the traffickers, but also as part of the strategy, we know from time to time when these operations are run that within that operation you'll pick up the consumer. So the consumer's not the target of the operation. It's to actually identify the suppliers and actually disrupt the supply to actually reduce the harm. That's the aim. Policing agencies have a role to keep the community safe and work to do that. So it is a tricky one, but for that reason, the consumer, so the user, not the supplier, is put in the diversion process. So from time to time, so it's not always easy to identify who the actual supplier is.
Mm-hmm. So when earlier you said you don't task people to go looking for users, you're saying that this doesn't contradict that.
No.
Here, Operation Safe Night, you're actually trying to get the suppliers.
It's to reduce accessibility to drugs, to identify who the suppliers are and reduce harm. Mm-hmm. But we do accept that in that process you do come across the user who might have a tablet or two for personal use, and that's why they're diverted. That's mm-hmm. why there's a diversion process, so that they're not then proceeding through the criminal justice system. But we accept it is a balance. But when we have, as there is in Paran, we had the high number of overdoses, some fatal, the majority not fatal. Policing agency, we have a role. Drugs are illegal, and we have to work with other agencies to try and actually reduce the harm.
So, Stan, from your perspective, is that a useful thing to be doing? Is that what the police should be doing?
Well, there are a couple of points to be made. The first is there's a bit of a legal issue around searching people and the use of dogs, and in New South Wales there's been a few cases which sort of raise questions, the police would say that a dog gives an indication which gives them the reasonable suspicion that they might need to conduct a search. There's researchers in Melbourne and cases in Sydney that have talked about the extent to which that's actually really happening, and the results of a New South Wales Ombudsman report in New South Wales indicated that only 20% of indications from dogs resulted in any drugs being found. So it's, you know, it's not a high success rate. I think, but the other issue, which is really important, is, and I take what Rick said, but there are also harms that have been documented, and I've got colleagues at RMIT, including Peter Mallins, who's actually out in Chapel Street at night at the moment researching this, that there are unintended consequences and there are things that people do because they're afraid of being picked up with drugs, and they include ingesting drugs suddenly and all that sort of stuff. And in there are cases in New South Wales and Queensland of people who've died, and there is evidence in coronial inquests that that's been a cause, a fear of being apprehended.
Mm-hmm. Can I just go back to the questioner originally? I mean, you obviously have a lot of knowledge of this, and do you work in that industry? Not the drugs industry. Do you work in the? Do you work in sort of the nighttime entertainment industry?
No, I've actually started an independent campaign against Operation Safe Night.
Sorry, and what's your issue? Is it with the dogs, or what's your problem?
Oh, where do I start? It's with the criminalising of drug use. We're going after people found with possession. It's the fact that this is a huge waste of police resources. It's the fact that people are made to feel unsafe and having their civil liberties taken their way. The right to privacy is now being taken away. And it's the fact that dogs are wrong 60 to 80% of the time.
Okay. Is that right, 60 to 80% of the time?
So I read some information on that earlier today. So from the people running the operation there, they are informing me that their success rate's around the 85 to 90% in terms of the detection. So from when the dog indicates there's drugs present, they're finding drugs present on 85 to 90% of the time.
It's actually I think this is... there's no easy answer to this issue, because drugs are illegal and the police have a job to do. But as Dan said, there are unintended consequences from those kind of operations. And if we just take a step back, the really big push that means that we are in this situation is because we have this huge focus on use rather than on harms. And if we switched our thinking and made it a bit broader and focused on harms that drugs cause rather than just use or not use, then we would have better solutions to these problems, I think.
So in terms of harms, most people will go out to a nightclub, they'll take a pill, they'll have a good time, they might feel a bit blue 2 days later, but there's not really much of a demonstrable harm. Is that what you're saying in that sort of context?
Yeah, I mean, there's always risks associated with legal or illegal drug use, but generally most people who take drugs do so very occasionally, less than once a month, and they take a small amount and they take it for a very short time in their lives. So in terms of potential harms, most of the harms do come from the drug being illegal and how it's manufactured. Mm-hmm. Precisely because it's illegal.
But I think Rick's point there is that the police are actually targeting...
Yeah.
The suppliers and users are being caught up as a byproduct of that.
Yes, and so in my mind, that is a significant harm for people using, being caught in a wider net, even if the intention is to capture the sellers of the drug. And as Stan said, people do things that are very risky when, particularly when sniffer dogs are around. They might have a couple of pills and they'll take them all at once because they don't want to get caught with pills on their person.
Mm-hmm. So, go on.
No, I was going to say, and that is a risk. And that's something that's considered and has been considered. We haven't had any evidence of that occurring in Victoria yet that's been reported to Victoria Police. Okay. But what we do know is that the majority of people dispose of the drugs.
Who shouted that out? Okay.
Hasty nightclub incidents where police raided a gay nightclub, strip searched everyone, people were dropping like flies. I mean, is this not history repeating itself?
I'm not aware of that.
$10 million lawsuit.
How long ago was that?
That was
15 years.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that the landscape has changed significantly since then. Would that be correct?
Yeah, it has. Look, it is a tricky one. You have a whole lot of overdoses. You have a whole lot of different types of drugs out there that are causing harm. It is illegal, as Nicole said, and we have a role. We have a role to play. And it's a fine balance, and we'll work with other agencies and we'll look at the most effective way that we can try and do it to reduce the harm. And the harm is the death and serious injuries that occur.
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Next question.
Yes, I think this question is directed to you, the psychologist.
Nicole,
yes. I'd like to know, for my own interest, and because this is something people ask me, about methamphetamine. What sort of treatment modalities are available for methamphetamine users?
That's a good question. I'll just start by saying that there's been a study a couple of years ago that just looked at outcomes from drug treatment more generally, people going into drug treatment and then coming out and what their success rate is. And methamphetamine users actually do the best in treatment out of all drug users, which it usually surprises people. So the first point is that there are effective treatments, and in fact the treatments are the same as they are for other drugs, for alcohol and other drugs. No, there's no medication like there is for heroin, for example, but we would treat it the same as we treat cannabis dependence and alcohol dependence and other drug dependence.
So that might be a good time to talk about treatment and rehabilitation as part of the criminal justice system and how often that's actually mandated and how effective that is. Nicole, would you like to start off on that?
I'll leave it to Stan to talk about the how often it occurs, but the outcomes of mandated treatment, when there's a choice involved, are pretty good. So especially drug courts, they've been evaluated many times and the outcomes seem to be as good as voluntary treatment. And part of that is because when you go to a drug court, you get a lot of scaffolding around you. You get a lot of people helping you to meet your goals for treatment.
Mm-hmm. And how often is it used, Stan?
Very frequently. It can feature in a whole range of different sentencing options. So from even a diversion, which is ultimately, if the person fulfills the conditions, won't count against them as a finding of guilt, people can be told to go and attend counselling or some other service, right through to community corrections orders. At the top end of the scale, there are sort of quite intensive orders in the community. There's the drug court, which is effectively dealing with people who are sentenced to a term of imprisonment, but they're allowed to stay in the community while they undergo treatment, and they're regularly tested for use, and if they mark up a couple of times, then they might be returned to prison. So it's sort of treatment with a very heavy, with a sword hanging over you kind of scenario, as well as carrots as well as the sticks in that case. So, there are issues around coercive treatment and so on, and whether it's effective and really the availability. So very often in Victoria, people are charged with criminal offences when they're, in the midst of offending because they're struggling with addiction and they can't access treatment. So accessibility is a big issue and that can impact on people's bail, for example. People are often remanded and they're not able to be bailed until they can get access to treatment.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a big problem.
It's a huge problem, mm-hmm. Yep.
And I came across this statistic which found that drug court participants committed 90% fewer drug trafficking offences after a drug treatment order compared to a control cohort group released from prison after 2 years who committed 71% more. So, I mean, those sorts of orders really do work. Mm. There's just not the resources, though.
Well, what's even more extraordinary about those statistics is that drug courts, at least in Victoria, are only available to people who are being sentenced to a term of imprisonment. So you can't... This is not low-level deals we're talking about.
Sure.
We're talking about people who've got long, intractable histories of drug use and linked to crime and offending, and those are actually the people that we're dealing with. And unfortunately, at the moment, we're dealing with quite a small number of people. So that intensive support does make a difference to people, but it's only available to a small number of people, and it's good that we're expanding that now. But again, these are the, I guess, the sort of very hard edge of offenders, and to get those results with that group is pretty amazing, but there's a huge spectrum below that of people who might have very serious drug addiction, and it might be having huge impacts, but because of their criminal history, they're not actually being sentenced at that level and not going to the drug court.
Is that a false economy then, in terms of punishment and also actual resources being put into dealing with that?
I think that there's a bit of a line where you need to look at the impact of drawing someone into the criminal justice system and netwiding, because that can itself have issues. So mm-hmm. if you've got a criminal conviction, your chances and prospects of employment, for example, are diminished quite substantially. But for people who need help and want it, there isn't enough there, and it can make a difference.
I think one of the things we should remember too is that the vast majority of people who use drugs don't need treatment, and so there's at the other end, at the diversion kind of end, people sometimes get diverted into treatment when they actually don't really need treatment. They've just been caught using. So we do need to be a bit careful about mandatory treatment, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Even though the effects are at the pointy end are
sure
good. Yeah.
Okay, let's have another question. Where are we?
Hello, I'm Judy Ryan. I'm from the Residents for Victoria Street Drug Solutions in North Richmond and Abbotsford, here tonight with quite a few of our fellow residents. There's many questions I'd like to ask, but we live in the heroin epicentre of Victoria. We're elated at Coroner Hawkins' recommendations to the government in February for an establishment of a medically supervised injecting centre similar to the one in Sydney, given that the fact that neither the state government or the opposition have any appetite for this, our community, which is really struggling with this health crisis, and we are quite friendly with the people who use drugs in our laneways, front yards, you know, toilet blocks, etc. We're looking at options in terms of trying to get traction here. One of them is civil disobedience. The other one is really hammering the cost this is to the taxpayers. And I'm interested in Rick's view on this, particularly as a police from the police services area. You know, outside our homes in North Richmond and Abbotsford, there are micers, ambulance, police officers 24/7. And as a taxpayer, I don't want that to happen. In Sydney, $3.7 million to have people resuscitated from overdoses. What is it costing our state to service these poor people who are overdosing and dying preventable deaths? And I'd really like the views of the whole panel. Thank you.
So I think that, broadly speaking, that's a question about should we have an injecting room and bearing in mind all of the costs of that, yeah. Rick. Yeah.
So, look, it's really tragic. We know that there's more overdoses in Yarra than there are elsewhere. We know our people are constantly identifying and charging the traffickers, but we have people at the other end of the spectrum in terms of that drug use that probably for most of them it's an uncontrollable addiction. And it's a health issue. It's a disease. They are suffering. And so it is tying up resources, both police, paramedics, and it is impacting on the community. And we're working really closely with the Yarra Council and others to try and address it. I mean, there is a parliamentary inquiry at the moment to examine the medical safe injecting facility.
Have police admitted to that?
Not yet. We're preparing a submission as well.
Can you tell us what you're going to say in that?
Well, ultimately, it's a matter for health and the government, this one.
It's your coppers who are dealing with this every day. Would they like to see that?
Our members are like the community. There are mixed views. There are very different views in our own members from right through the spectrum, and I hear it quite regularly. I think it's one that We work with the community. We need to understand the concerns of the community. We need the evidence in support of it. That'll all be put to the inquiry, and then the inquiry will determine whether or not to pass this bill that's been put forward.
And what is the evidence, Nicole or Stan, about that?
Look, the resistance to these kinds of measures is a direct result of our focus on use over harms. And if we did focus more on harms, then this would be an absolute no-brainer. There's ample evidence in Australia and across the world that safe injecting facilities reduce harm significantly. They save lives and they also divert people into treatment. And so if we're trying to reduce both harms and drug use in the community, they are they're an excellent way to do that.
Mm-hmm. To be honest, I think the issue is a political one, and we try and make arguments about cost and so on, but it's interesting when you talk about the costs. If you think about criminal justice, for example, we keep locking people up and that's costing a lot of money, and it's money that's not being used on schools or hospitals, but we still do it. And I think someone like Albert Einstein said that the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. But that's what we're doing. We've been doing it for a long time. I think this is one of those examples. I can't really see any barriers. Even the person who's asked the question is indicating that the community supports it. And I think it's just the politics. We can't seem to get past the idea that there might be things that we could do to reduce harm, but also to maintain the government maintaining its message about drugs and they're unlawful and they're harmful.
So we sort of can't chew gum and walk at the same time.
I think that's the problem. I think the state of our debate now really limits our options.
Mm-hmm. Judy, just to go back to you, because where are you? There you are. So what do you feel like? Well, obviously you say within your own community there in North Richmond there's strong support for it. What is your perception of the wider support in the broader Victorian community for it?
Look, I can't answer that in terms of data, obviously, but one of the things that we do know from the coroner's office is that 30% of people who die of fatal overdoses, obviously they die if they're fatal, 30% come from our area. 70% come from across Melbourne and the state of Victoria. So it's actually a state issue. Mm-hmm. It's not just a North Richmond, Abbotsford issue. So the coroner's office knows this. They know that it is broad spectrum stuff. So as far as acceptance in the broader community, until people have the experience of a fatal overdose in their death, they don't get it. And I understand that. But there'd be people across our state who would understand what we're talking about if only Johnny or Judy went to, injected in a supervised situation, they'd still be alive. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a feeling that, and people who I speak to who have had fatalities in their family just get it so much. They know, and it's Sydney is just a great example of how straightforward it is, really,
Thank you, Judy. Thank you.
I just wanted to reiterate that there has never been a death within a safe injecting facility anywhere in the world. And the fundamental premise is that nobody should die from using drugs. And if we all believed that, then there wouldn't be a problem. There wouldn't even be a question about this.
So does it encourage use?
No, it doesn't encourage use. Those people are going to be using anyway, and it just encourages safe use.
Mm-hmm. There's one part I'm not certain about still with this is why Yarra for me? So many years ago, I was a detective at St Kilda, and so St Kilda, Footscray and Springvale were the three areas that had the high number of overdoses. I still can't understand or can't see any intelligence evidence that determines why Yarra is actually...
You mean a hotspot of use or the sort of proposed location
for
the use?
No, why we actually have more overdoses there... I don't know whether Judy actually knows that.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know specifically, but I've been told that apparently some senior police officer who used to work around that area said if you went to an urban designer and you said design an area that is just a red-hot dissemination using spot for illicit drugs, you develop North Richmond because of the transport and the laneways and the, you know, the busy shopping strip, you know, eating strip. It's just movement. It's people can slip in and out. We see them all the time. We know who the users are. Like, we're across all of it. We know it all. Yeah. And we can see it, and you know, and I've got a beautiful laneway on my northern side. If I was using drugs, I'd use it down there too, because it's just, it's so nice. And we play nice music in our front yard and stuff, well, you know. But, you know, I just think that's why. Yeah. So the reality is it's going to stay like it, but we just need proper management and harm reduction, because it's going to keep happening. And in fact, it's going to get worse if news out of the rest of the world with the fentanyl, you know, tsunami, I've heard it called.
Okay, hello. Thank you very much, Judy. We'll have to move on to a different subject, but obviously that's one of the hot topics at this stage, particularly given the coroner's point of view and the view shared by people up here on stage. Okay, what's our next question?
Hi. I just wanted to reflect on sort of media reporting of drug use and some of the sensationalisation that's occurring. And I wondered, my question is to the panel, what role do you think stigmatisation plays on people not accessing assistance if they need it, or if they want it?
Yeah, God, don't get me started on the media reporting. It is a huge problem, and I do understand the media's need to tell a really good story, but when it's exaggerated, it does create stigma. There's no doubt about that. There's been research that shows that it's the type of reporting is linked to the amount of marginalisation in the community and the stigma that people who use drugs feel. And there's also research that clearly links feeling stigmatised to not seeking help and not seeking treatment. So it's a really huge problem. If we're trying to reduce the harms, and even if we assume that we're trying to reduce use of drugs in the community, then stigmatising people is not the way to do it. It's counterproductive.
Rick, you're a policeman. You must love the media.
I think the sensationalist reporting is not helpful. It's a bit like the term the war on drugs. It's not a war on drugs. It's not going to be won, lost with a few battles. It's a problem in society, in some parts of society, that is causing significant harm for a lot of people, and we need to work... We need to collaborate, we need to work closely with all sectors, academics, other government agencies, the community, to look at how best we can work together to reduce the harm and catch those suppliers that are preying on vulnerable people, that are lacing drugs with fentanyl to get more and more people addicted, to create a niche market so as they can make more money.
Having, you know, heard what you've said, particularly about your members in rural areas and people treating users in rural areas, it does sound that from their perspective they would feel like they're at war.
Yeah, no, I don't feel that they're at war. They just know that it's impacting significantly on the local community and the work that they do. And our people absolutely believe that treatment and dealing with the people who have the addiction is necessary. And so, you know, our referral system, they work really closely with local agencies in terms of that referral. So they don't feel they're at war, but they just see that it's just causing so much harm in the community. And that's the sad bit sometimes as a police person. You do the death messages. You know, you attend the fatal car accidents for the kids and other people where illicit drugs are in the system. You know, in 2015, for the first time, we saw deaths on the roads with illicit drugs in the system higher than alcohol. It's just gradually got higher and higher. So last year...
Was that mostly iced, you know? Do you know what the drugs were?
Crystal meth is a significant one, but it's a whole range of drugs. But so, you know, last year, 206 dead on the road, 58 drivers or riders with illicit drugs in their system. So it's actually increasing more and more. 400-odd people seriously injured who had illicit drugs in their system. So it's causing more and more harm. And so from our frontline members' perspective, they see this harm time after time. They have to tell the parents that their son or daughter died. And so they just want to be much more effective in working with other agencies to actually reduce that harm.
Did you want to...
Yeah, look, on the issue of stigmatisation, I think part of the problem is that our governments are involved in that practice themselves. So the recent announcement in the budget, for example, about singling out drug users for testing is an example of that, and it goes right back. I remember it was about 2003, the then government was looking at amending the Disability Discrimination Act to make it lawful to discriminate against drug users, and I was involved in a campaign which ultimately led to that proposal being abandoned. But it just shows that that, you know, at all levels, people are prepared to treat drug users differently, and that has an impact, as Nicole said, on all sorts of things, including health outcomes, blood-borne viruses, all those sorts of things.
So what do you think the impact of that policy announced in the budget is actually going to be?
Well, it sounds like a bit of a thought bubble, so I'll be very interested to see how they implement it, and heard all sorts of wild and wonderful ideas about how they're going to determine which of the sites they'll choose. People are very interested in looking at sewerage at the moment to find out where people are using drugs. That's one of the reasons it's been given. But look, I think it's likely to go the way of all of those other proposals, which is to, I guess, separate people from sort of dealing with the real issues, and often, you know, putting people who might be, you know, in crisis, who might need access to pensions or benefits or housing, it's not going to help them. It's not going to help them get housing.
Do you think your average taxpayer, though, would have a right to think that their taxes aren't going to go in someone's arm?
Yeah, but they may or may not. I don't know. I mean, do we say that people can spend their money on? It's sort of, you know, people have tried that with various cards and that sort of stuff, but, you know, it's still lawful to gamble, it's still lawful to, you know, buy cigarettes and buy alcohol and all that sort of stuff, and as yet we're not saying that you can only use payments for this or that purpose, although there are some cards that are being used in, for example, remote Aboriginal communities to limit spending on those sorts of things. I just think it's a response to the kinds of media that we've seen, which reflect a pretty average view of what, you know, human beings should think about each other.
Okay, all right. Where's our next question, please?
Nicole, I was really interested that you started the discussion around keeping young people in schools, and I'm the parent of a child who's got, you know, a fairly regular and serious drug issue, and he's had it since he was 14. His first exposure to the drugs were in the school community. It was older kids in the school dealing to him. And I've just been really interested with... We've had a number of issues within the school, and with the school being able to deal with the problem. Mainly, I think, because as a parent and as a school, there's a lot of stigma around your child having a drug problem. There's a lot of stigma around the school having a drug issue in the school, so it can't be spoken about openly. And also, I think a lot of the teachers have been incredibly well-meaning, but they are not don't really have the skills to deal with the problem or deal with my son. And there seems to be a bit of a service model gap for actually having services coming into school to deal with the problem. And I think a lot of this is around the secrecy. And I'm just wondering from, like, a policy research or program perspective, is there anything happening looking at this as an issue, or any programs that are in place that you could tell me about?
Okay, wow, that's a big question. I think the first thing is the rate of use of particularly illicit drugs among kids at school is very low, but there are kids that are going to get into trouble with it. Some of them have a lot of risk factors, and sometimes they don't at all. What we know about prevention of drug problems in young people is that it needs to start really early. That education needs to start early. and it needs to be integrated into the school. It's no good, for example, sorry, Rick, police coming into the school, giving lectures to kids, that doesn't work very well. Ex-users coming into schools, giving talks, that doesn't work very well. In fact, those kind of measures actually increase kids' interest in using drugs, and so that's, like, not what we really want at all.
So what does work, then?
We have some...
This is slightly diverting from the drug laws issue, which is what we're meant to be talking about, but it's very germane to the...
Yeah,
problem,
I think
isn't it?
I think it is still about prevention policy and
sure.
Education policy, which is really important in our prevention efforts in reducing the harms from drugs.
Yeah.
Over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of research into what works in school drug education, and there's a lot of programs that are throughout a lot of schools, in fact, at my son's school, that don't work very well but continue to be used. And there's a couple that we've developed in Australia that are very effective that are starting to get traction. So I guess the first thing is that we should be using evidence-based intervention in and prevention everywhere, but particularly at that school level. And we do know that particularly targeted interventions for kids like your son, who are either already at risk or are already using, those interventions work very well. But it's really, as you said, it's really hard to get those into schools because of the stigma around it.
So just to briefly go back to if police lectures don't work, if ex-user lectures don't work, just as a very broad brushstroke, what actually does work in preventing children from starting drugs?
Things that work include programs that are integrated into the school curriculum that focus on a broad range of topics, not just about drugs, but about healthy lifestyle, about resilience, and about health more generally, and they're generally better if they're delivered within the school system, not mm-hmm. from
people outside. So by teachers rather than
by
specialists?
By teachers
right.
or specialists, health professionals okay. within the school. And it's no good doing bits and pieces. It needs to be a program. And there's two particular programs in Australia that have been developed through a lot of research that have been shown to be quite effective.
That's really interesting. I'm sure we could do a whole hour on,
sure
on that.
Could.
That's a very different, interesting area.
Jeff?
We do have some people who have some questions down the front. Is there anything up the back as well? Okay, so we've got... Yeah, let's go up the back, and then we'll go other question up the back, and then there's a lady down the front. Did you still want to ask a question down here as well? Yeah, all right. Or we might go to the middle, and then if we've still got time. There's only 8 minutes left, folks.
Thanks,
I've got Donald. A big... clock up here, which is explodes when
speak
it gets
quickly.
Down to zero. Yeah.
Thanks, panel. I have a question for Nicole and Stan. I'm interested in your thoughts on whether different drugs should have different types of regulations and limitations applied to them. And I'm particularly interested in your thoughts on what, if any, limitations and controls should be applied to methamphetamine.
I might just let you take that, Stan, because it sort of relates to what we were talking about in the green room, doesn't it? About
classification. Sure.
Yeah.
So one interesting thing is in Victoria and in Australia we have we don't have a harm-based classification of drugs, so we don't regulate drugs predominantly. Generally speaking, this is true. We don't say that if you're convicted of trafficking in cannabis that you will face a different penalty to someone who's convicted of trafficking in, say, heroin. We have a quantity-based system where it's really about all drugs of dependence in the Act are treated the same. And I was actually involved when I was at Fitzroy Legal Service in an attempt through a sort of test case to get the Court of Appeal to hear evidence about the relative harmfulness of different drugs. And that's not an easy task because, as we know, the substance itself doesn't determine the harm. It's the way in which it's used and the context in which it's used and all those sorts of things. But we literally don't have any real distinction made apart from some very minor stuff at the bottom end in terms of the accessibility of drug diversion options for people charged with very small amounts of drugs. So, yeah, it's something that we could and should consider, and it's something that is the case in New Zealand and the UK where there are different categories of drugs. There's, class A, B and C, and each of them are treated on the basis of what's thought to be scientific evidence about their harmfulness, and the parliaments over there hear evidence from panel of experts about the classification of those drugs, and then the responses to those at law are related to the harmfulness.
Is that something that you're looking at in your review of policing drug policy, Rick?
Well, it's certainly come up, and it and I agree it's worthy of consideration. Because certain drugs do contribute far more harm than other drugs. So I understand there's a couple of areas that are providing submissions requesting that be examined in the drug law reform inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And the question was also specifically about methamphetamine, crystal methamphetamine, which would you both agree is sort of on the harm scale can be, it's one of the higher harm drugs?
Yeah, look, I like everyone else, I read about, what's happening and so on, but I'm not an expert on the harms associated with it. It may or may not be the case that there are more people being charged with that, but I think that's got a lot to do with supply issues. So, when I was a lawyer working this area in the 90s, heroin was, it was all happening around heroin, but things change over time depending on lots of, very large factors, including, what's available, I think there was a law introduced at one point that regulated the use of safrol, which is a key ingredient in MDMA manufacture, which led to changes in supply for that particular drug.
Okay. I will move on because I do want to get a few more questions in before we end. Yeah.
Hi.
And then was there another question way up the very back that we were... No, okay. Yes, please.
Hi. My question's around... random drug testing on roads, and it seems to have been evident that a lot of people that are being coming back with positive tests, particularly for marijuana users, they're not actually under the they're not intoxicated at the time of receiving the positive test. And my question was regarding what kind of legal rights and protections there are for people that aren't actually intoxicated and aren't necessarily dangerous drivers, but are being flagged and charged for driving under the influence of drugs, and whether or not those the policy surrounding that reflects the police stance on approaching dealers rather than users of drugs.
Well, I think there was one point where you said, are there any defences or something like that? There are none, and the roadside testing of drugs under the Road Safety Act is testing for the presence in any concentration of some drugs in your system. So it's not based on a level of impairment like the blood alcohol rule of 0.05. It's simply in the presence of a drug in your system.
So you'll get charged if you have marijuana in your system, which I believe can last for weeks or months or in the system, you can get charged with an offence and there's no defence.
Yeah, you get charged with having the presence of a drug in your system.
The window of testing is getting smaller and smaller. So in that sense, we're getting closer to impairment. But this is the big problem with testing welfare recipients, testing in workplaces and testing on the roads, is that exactly that, it doesn't indicate impairment at all. It's really on the grounds of potential safety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's the point?
That would be my question.
Yeah. So, in terms of the laws of the day, and we uphold the laws of the day, we know that illicit drugs in the system contributes to a significant amount of harm on the road. We know that. So, as I said, 58 people of 206 that died on the road had illicit drugs in their system. The drivers of, or riders of the cars or riders of the motorbikes or drivers of the cars. So in terms of targeting the user, I think it differentiate between the two in terms of when someone's behind the wheel and is putting their lives at risk, the lives of others at risk, we uphold the right. And
sure, but if someone had a joint 3 weeks ago and is coming up with a positive test, and therefore your members are obliged to charge them, is that useful?
Well, we don't know when they had their joint.
Mm. which is a problem.
Yeah, so right? All we know is that the laws currently stipulate, as Stan articulated, that they have illicit drugs in their system, mm-hmm. and that's the law. There is no measure of impairment around that.
And is that scientifically impossible to do for certain drugs like marijuana? Does anyone know?
Yeah, about impairment?
That. Yeah.
Yeah, drug testing won't test for impairment.
Right. And it
can never test for impairment.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't test for quantities which might indicate impairment.
The drug test that the police use, sorry, I don't want to talk in for the police, but those tests are getting better and better at a smaller window. So most of them will test in the last 24 to 48 hours of okay. use. But still, if you used even ecstasy or speed a day ago, you would not be intoxicated,
you could be pretty sleep deprived.
You could be, and even if you were intoxicated on small amounts of speed, your driving might actually be better. So it doesn't necessarily indicate
don't
impairment
try this
at all.
At home, yeah, folks, but don't. Do yeah. not try this.
I don't know that that's the right message.
But I think the point is that it can't indicate whether you're a good driver or not.
Okay, all right. Well, look, I'm afraid that we have run out of time. I'm very sorry, but look, those were all really very relevant questions, and we could do another hour on this subject. So thank you very much all for coming out. If we could thank Assistant Commissioner Rick Nugent, Stan Winford and Nicole Lee, bringing their expertise this evening. Thanks very much, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.